So the laboratory of La Jetée is a dark space of knowledge. Not a transparent and public structure, but a secret and illegal site. It is located underneath the surface of the city of Paris that is completely destroyed and contaminated. As the narrator explains, the scientists work in an underground network of galleries beneath the Palais de Chaillot. This network is populated by those who, after World War III, believed themselves to be the victors and those who are treated as their prisoners. The narrator is quite explicit here. He says that the victors stand guard over an empire of rats. Later on, he will describe the underground network beneath Chaillot as a camp. And in this camp, the victors carry out experiments on human test subjects chosen from the prisoners. In the course of these experiments, we are told, many test subjects are killed or become insane. In other words, even before the protagonist of the movie starts to travel into the past and the future, La Jetée's laboratory is also a space of recollection, that is, of memory. As we all recall, it was the Esplanade du Trocadéro, that is, the terrace of the Palais de Chaillot, where Hitler and other Nazis were standing, the Eiffel Tower in their backs in June 1940, when translating their military action against France into a haunting image. In Marcus' movie, it appears as if the Nazis had continued to rage, as if they had actually destroyed Paris and won the war. It is not by coincidence, then, that the laboratory scientists in La Jetée speak German. Or to be more precise, they whisper in German. When watching the movie in its original version, so in the French version, the result is rather uncanny. In between the clear and distinct utterances of the French narrator, bits and pieces of German language suddenly appear. Perhaps the effect is especially striking in native German speakers, and I guess it is meant to be that way. It feels as if the movie was directly addressing yourself. So this, unfortunately, we won't have with the German version we are going to see afterwards. What you hear when carefully listening are the only actual dialogues of the movie, and there are five of them, all rather short ones. The intensity with which these dialogues impact on the spectator can be compared to the intensity of the famous sequence that shows the awakening of the woman. In both cases, the fixity of Marker's ciné roman is suspended, and for some seconds we feel drawn into an actual motion picture, in one case visually, the opening eye, and in the other one acoustically. And obviously in radically different directions, whereas the gaze of the woman is connected to desire and life, the whispering of the scientists stands for knowledge and death. If I was asked to phrase this as an argument, I would say that both these sequences, the opening of the eye as well as the whispering scientists, are referring to one of the crucial topics or objects of the entire movie, namely eye movements. And I would add that much of La Jetée's interest, its almost pressing actuality, lies in the fact that it directs our attention to the fragility of this object. As we all know, eye movements have been turned in the meantime into a literally speculative object, thoroughly threatened to be commercialized by means of sensors and digital technologies. Now, to elaborate on this, I will proceed in two steps. I will first explore the iconography of La Jetée's laboratory, and then what we might call its audiography. It is true that the images of the laboratory in the movie do not show us a great deal about it. All we see is a male test person lying in a hammock. He wears a cabled eye mask. Besides the hammock, two scientists are standing, and on other shots, they are also sitting. They observe the experiment. On earlier shots, we see that to start the experiment, the scientists inject a substance into the body of the test subject, but it remains unclear whether it is a drug or some virus, whether it is a mind-altering substance or some sleep-inducing stuff. What we then see is precisely what the scientists observe. Once the effect of the injection sets in, the test person is suffering, tormented by spasms and convulsions. Despite these rather dramatic aspects, the general aesthetic of the experimental setup is highly evocative of the setups used in sleep research. Physiologist Nathaniel Kleitman is often quoted as the founding father of experimental sleep research, and together with his assistant, Eugene Azarinsky, Kleitman discovered the phenomenon of rapid eye movements, or REM, in 1953. To study these movements, the two scientists used so-called electro-oculograms. By means of electrodes placed on the skin surrounding the eyes, they translated eye movements into graphical curves. And I would argue that the cabled eye mask that the main character is wearing during these experiments alludes precisely to this technique. So much for the iconography. Now let us turn to the whispering scientists. They give us some additional information about the experiment they perform. First, the two scientists talking to each other stand in a specific hierarchical relationship to each other, since one, obviously the assistant, calls the other one professor. Second, it becomes clear that their observations are not restricted to the naked eye.
Die Instrumente sind in Ordnung.
The assistant whispers at one point, and later the professor asks,
Was sagt das Kardiogramm?
We don't see the corresponding device on the shots, still we hear the beating heart of the test person. And finally, it becomes clear that the two scientists are doing what every lab scientist does, they process data. Thus, they read off their instruments.
19, 20, ah, 23, ah, schon bedeutend langsamer, 27, 29.
And they measure time.
Wenn es nach 3 Minuten aussetzt, da stimmt was nicht. 3 Minuten, ja.
Plus, they observe body movements.
Ja, die Kontraktion nimmt zu. Ja, das ist ein merkwürdiger Reflex. Das ist eine Iris. Das kommt vom Thalamus, glaube ich.
So to sum up, we could say that we encounter here the basic structure or diagram of time-based experiments at the borderline between physiology and psychology as it was defined since the days of Helmholtz. We have time-measuring instruments on the one side and inscription devices for recording bodily reactions, contractions, and convulsions on the other side. And in between, we have hypotheses formulated about the brain processes that might be the cause for the recorded events. In other words, what is pictured here is in fact an assault of time on life mediated through the laboratory. In Lagité's laboratory, precision instruments are about to conquer the unconscious body. There is more, however. The grandness of Marcus' movie, at least in my eyes, lies in the fact that he depicts this assault of time on the rest of life not as a one-dimensional process, but as an authentic debate, a kind of battle. When the narrator tells us the camp police spies on dreams, this is only half of the truth, since it's not clear at all if the test subject is traveling into his own past or if he's producing new delusions. In fact, we are told about the test person that he is profoundly unsure, quote, whether he made up what he sees, or whether he's only dreaming, if that's the appropriate alternative. In addition, there is one dialogue between the scientists that clearly shows their work is not being restricted to observe, but that they intervene into the experience of the test person.
So, jetzt haben wir ihn soweit. Die Hälfte von ihm ist hier, die andere Hälfte, die ist in der Vergangenheit. So. Das ist ja sehr schön. Dieser erste Teil ist ausgezeichnet gelungen. Jetzt müssen wir ihn bloß lange genug in der Vergangenheit behalten. Ja, wir müssen ihn natürlich zu dem Mädchen bringen.
So when the two scientists go so far as to mention a lever they can use in order to make the woman appear, it seems the entire laboratory setup undergoes a kind of gestalt switch. The two scientists are not scientists any longer. They have transformed themselves into directors. What looked like a scientific experiment turns out to be a kind of experimental cinema, a precisely controlled phantasmagoria. And at this point, we should come back once again to the site where the action takes place. Fortunately, the Palais de Chaillot is not only tied to Hitler's appearance in Paris. For decades, it was the place where the Cinémathèque Française was located. In other words, the underground network of galleries where La Jetée's laboratory is installed is nothing else than a film archive, a space of cinematic recollection. And if he was wanting to highlight this connection, Marker has Jacques Ledoux, the former director of the Cinémathèque Royale in Brussels, playing the role of one of the scientists. Now, this gestalt switch from experimentation to cinematography can be read as suggesting that Marker was convinced, indeed, that in our day, it is time which, mediated through the gaze, attacks life. However, he seems also to suggest that the battle is not lost. Science and technology might aim to register, measure, and control our eye movements, but cinematography has the ability and the power to trigger as well as to suspend eye movements without recording them. And perhaps this is why the movie is composed out of stills. By the same token, cinematography is in a position to awaken and enforce the feel for the mental image inside of us that resist command and control. And as you will see in the movie, this is also a question of glasses. The glasses are sort of crucial elements in the entire movie. Okay, I stop here and thank you for your attention. And I think we sort of move on immediately to the discussion. So Stefan and Jimena, please join me here on stage. I get my papers and